Hey, this is Jonathan Goodman, and I have incredibly exciting news. My book, The Obvious Choice, is now available for purchase in Kindle, in Audible, and in hardcover. Anywhere that you find books, please go on Amazon, please go to whatever bookstore you like, buy yourself a copy, buy a copy for a friend. Hope that you absolutely love it. Now let's get into the show.
It's been almost 2 months since The Obvious Choice was released, and lots of people have been asking me how it's been going. If I'm honest, my answer is not great. I've been disappointed with sales, and so was my publisher. What makes it harder to swallow is how good the feedback has been almost unanimously. People who have read or listened to the book have loved it. The reviews across both Amazon and Goodreads, they reflect this. The problem, though, is that not many people have given the book a chance. Now, this disconnect between quality and reach, it's not unique to books. It's the universal challenge of any worthwhile creation. How do you get your best work in front of the right people? I'm not an exceptional person, but I am a grower. I do have the ability to look at my shortcomings and improve for the future. So I'm sharing 5 crucial lessons I've learned from this experience, not to complain, but to illuminate the path for anybody bringing something valuable into this noisy world. Whether you're launching a product, sell a service, creating art, these 5 lessons transcend any specific field. Positioning, the art of framing value. People buy business books because they're hoping for frameworks to solve their immediate problems, getting more leads, improving sales, scaling staff. Choice isn't like that. It's a self-help book disguised as a business book. It's about finding your way in a world gone mad, one that's designed to distract you. But it was positioned as a book to help you make more money. And honestly, I underestimated just how little the world wants another business book. This applies beyond books. The fitness instructor who positions their service as building a better body versus creating sustainable health habits will attract entirely different clients, even if the actual training is identical. If somebody knows that they have a problem, they'll buy a solution. General information, irrelevant of how useful it is or how much a person needs it, doesn't sell the way it used to. Distraction and overwhelm, they're two strong forces. In my case, everybody these days wants to know how to build a bigger and more engaged following on social media, and I wrote a book that, in large part, tells them that that's a waste of time, which I still believe to be true. But nobody wants that. Nobody's waking up in the morning and looking in the mirror and saying to themselves, I hope somebody tells me that this thing I'm working hard on and stressing over is a waste of time and presents a different way. The way your book, product, or service is framed determines who finds it and how they engage with it. My mistake wasn't just about marketing, it was about clarity of purpose. Ask yourself, what problem does your audience believe they have versus what problem you're actually solving? The gap between these two perspectives often determines success or failure. A few questions to filter your positioning through. Number 1, what's your audience searching for right now? And number 2, what language do they use to describe their challenge? Figure this out by looking at headlines of magazines that serve your audiences, the language used in best-selling books, or the content shared by the top thought leaders that market to your people. Then, go one step deeper and read comments on their posts and write down the words and phrases actually being used. In my case, I created a thoughtful exploration of finding purpose in a distractive world, but I packaged it as just another business growth manual. And I missed the sweet spot. Once people read it, they get it, but they have to read it to get it. People say not to judge a book by its cover, which is ridiculous. Of course you should judge a book by its cover. That's why books have covers. Getting the positioning right is only the first step. Even more important is ensuring you're speaking to the right audience in the first place. Audience, quality is more important than quantity. In Choice, I write, if the way you've built an audience is inconsistent with the product or service you want to sell, you'll end up rich with likes but poor with dollars. I anticipated that I'd have this problem, even called it out in the book. A part of me is happy because my experience has proved out the lesson in the book. Another part of me is upset because of just how true this lesson has proved to be. Having thousands of followers who don't convert into customers isn't just a business problem. It's a fundamental misalignment between who you've attracted and what you're offering. The metrics that feel good, followers, likes, subscribers, can become a mirage that obscures the metrics that matter, engagement, conversions, and revenue. I built an audience of people who work in fitness over the last 15 years. For the most part, people who work in fitness are disinterested in the business. They might say they want to grow the business, but then they'll buy a seventh course having to do with fitness or nutrition before seriously studying anything to do with business or marketing, which I totally get. They love fitness. They don't love business. Here's another passage from The Obvious Choice that bears repeating. Superficial engagement metrics such as likes, comments, shares, and followers are all measures, not targets. Relying on them as your only insights is like playing a game with no scoreboard. In my coaching company, in the online trainer mentorship, we track how many inbound direct messages that are inquiries that we receive. Many of us build our platforms backwards. We create content that's easily consumable, build an audience around it, then try to sell something that doesn't align or requires a different level of commitment. The strongman lifting logs over his head for likes on social media that trains new moms. The 21-year-old ripped influencer who helps busy parents. The entertainer who comes out with a flavored water supposed to help you work out better or focus better or hydrate more, as if any of those things solve the underlying problem. As John Delaney says, if your house is on fire and there's an alarm going off, it's not the alarm that's the problem. The result's predictable, an audience that loves what you say but doesn't value what you sell. Don't ask, how do I convert my existing audience? Instead, ask, how do I begin attracting the audience that aligns with my true purpose? I've made some changes since Choice was released to better align my platforms with my work. And as a result, my audience has shrank. My email list has lost over 6,000 subscribers. Instagram's down 5,000 plus. And while seeing the numbers go down can be hard to swallow, I know the truth. Metrics are like a spotlight, said Jonah Berger, who's a marketing professor at Wharton, wrote Contagious, Why Things Catch On. He said, they shine attention on something. If that's what we want to optimize, great. But if it's not, we need to be careful because it may encourage us to optimize whatever it's focused on. Goodhart's Law states, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. Superficial engagement metrics such as likes, comments, shares, and followers are all measures, not targets. Relying on them as your only insights is like playing a game with no scoreboard. I'm still hopeful that the book will expand outside of the fitness industry. Going in, I knew that this was going to be a mountain that I'd have to climb, but if it happens, it's going to take a long time. Last week, a trainer that bought my book told me that she gave a copy to her partner, who's a real estate agent. She said that that agent read it, then immediately bought copies for the 10 realtors that worked in her office. I hope more of that happens, but hope's an opiate, not a strategy. Which is why I need to move into other markets, and that's going to be hard, because when you change focus, you start over. Once you've aligned your offering with the right audience, you'll still face another challenge, the contextual nature of influence. Influence, the contextual boundaries of your authority. In the fitness industry, I can get a lot of people to answer my messages. In other industries, not so much. What we perceive as global status is actually a collection of micro-reputations, each confined to its own ecosystem. Your authority isn't a portable asset you carry from space to space. It's deeply embedded in the relationships, in the history, in the social proof you built with specific communities. This isn't just about fame or follower counts. It's true for all forms of credibility. The respected professor who switches universities and has to reestablish classroom rapport, the business leader who moves industries and finds their expertise questioned, the community leader who moves homes and becomes just another neighbor. John Barodi sent me a text one day. He co-founded Precision Nutrition, sold it for close to $200 million. The guy is now all in on youth athletic coaching, starting over in a new field. Something he said stuck with me. He said, it's important to note when starting any new gig, you sort of start over the stage as a yes from scratch, regardless of where you were at in your previous life. This reality hit me hard during my launch. I got ignored by people I thought would respond, the self-publishing guru, the online course expert, the newsletter wizard, each with smaller platforms than mine. But in their worlds, they...
If you've listened this far into the podcast, I want to invite you to buy a copy of my new book, The Obvious Choice. It's available now. A lot of people have been asking me what the book's about. The central premise is that it's learning how to position yourself as the clear and trusted answer to a specific group's problems. You see, a lot of people these days are trying to become famous to the faceless, anonymous internet. Instead of becoming the obvious choice to a smaller amount of people who are going to buy from you. It's actually much better, much more profitable, much easier and much faster and much less stressful to be obviously perfect, to a smaller amount of people, then just okay to a lot of people who are never going to buy you. You see, you don't need to be the best at everything or chase the largest audience. You need to become the most relevant to your people. What I do is I emphasize the importance of understanding your audience's needs, meeting them where they already are, and delivering such value that choosing anyone else feels irrational. And so pick up a copy of the book. It's in Kindle, it's in Audible, it's in hardcover, wherever you find books. Hope that you absolutely love it.
It mattered, and I didn't. A simple test confirmed this. I messaged somebody on X where I'm unknown and got a thumbs up. I sent that same message to that same person on Instagram where my follower count makes me look important. And suddenly they loved my work and wanted to talk shop, even though they'd never heard of me before. This isn't cynical. It's reality. We're all simultaneously somebody and nobody depending on where we stand. There's two key principles that emerge. Number one, compound in one place. There's immense value in building deep reputation in one field over time. Reputation compounds when you stay consistent within a specific context. And number two, reset the expectations when moving. If you choose to expand into new territories, be mentally prepared to be a beginner again. Ask yourself, can you separate your previously earned identity from your current status in a world where, once again, nobody gives a shit who you are? I'm back to scratching and clawing, trying to make a name for myself. Back in the good old days, I'd stay up late after clients and write articles in the corner of my one-bedroom apartment, hoping, begging, anybody would pay attention. Well, it's 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and here I am again, writing an article. Thinking not in weeks and months or even years, but in decades. Hoping I can do what I did in the fitness industry, but on a bigger, worldwide scale. And you know what? It's hella fun. Mastery. The illusion of transferable excellence. This is embarrassing. Whatever. Here goes. I botched my podcast interviews. Two of the bigger shows that I was interviewed for sent a message on book launch day to say that the episode didn't meet their quality standards and would not be published. If you wake up in the morning and you see a jerk, maybe you saw a jerk. But then if you go for a walk that same day and see another jerk, then I've got bad news for you. You're the jerk. I was pissed when it first happened, blaming the host. When it happened again, I realized that I was the problem. It hurt. I was pissed. But a few hours later, I put my ego aside and asked for feedback. And what he sent back hit me like a ton of bricks. At the end of it, I'm happy I asked for feedback. I'm grateful that he gave me useful feedback. Because how you practice is how you will perform. So here's what actually happened with that podcast thing. You see, I've recorded over 1,000 podcast episodes. I figured I had it in the bag. I was going to go on all these shows and I was going to blow them away. I didn't practice. I just went in there and I ripped it. And that was a mistake because all of that time I'd been practicing the wrong way. Over 800 of the podcast episodes I'd recorded were on my own show. The format of that show was designed around me speaking for 80 to 90% of the time. Almost every interview for other shows I've ever done were ones from the fitness industry where I knew the host well. It was a natural conversation between friends. Neither prepared me to be interviewed by well-prepared hosts to audiences who didn't know me. What looks like transferable expertise often contains hidden contextual elements we don't recognize until we fail. The skills that make you exceptional in one environment may be precisely what undermines you in another. Mastery is highly contextual. There's examples everywhere. The star employee who struggles after promotion to management, the successful small business owner who fails when scaling up. How bad of a basketball coach Michael Jordan was. Remember that? All examples of how mastery in one context don't automatically transfer to another. There's two lessons I can pull out here. The first is to practice deliberately, and the second is to always ask for honest, almost uncomfortable feedback. You see, the mark of a true professional isn't flawless performance in familiar territory. It's the willingness to become a student again at the edges of your competence. What happened sucks. But I'm grateful it happened. It exposed me to an area of improvement. Putting yourself out there and stretching at the edge of your comfort and competency will show you where you need to improve. But there's an even deeper lesson about expectations that completes this journey. Self-reliance, the ultimate liberation. The final lesson was both the most painful and liberating. It transcends creative work and touches on a fundamental truth about all human endeavors. By and large, I was disappointed by the lack of support I got from colleagues and friends for my book launch. Not in every case, but in many cases. Call it the expectation-reality gap. During the writing and editing process, friends and colleagues were in my corner encouraging me on. Then the book came out. A few showed up for me in big ways, but most didn't. And the disappointment gap got huge. We experience disappointment not because others fail us, but because our mental models don't recognize that each person is the protagonist of their own story, not a supporting character in ours. As time passed, the gap decreased. Perhaps that's why I'm writing this article. Liberated, entering into self-sufficiency, firmly appreciative that I'm on my own. There's no white and shining armor that's going to show up and make all of my hopes and dreams come true. That it's up to me, damn it. It's up to me. As I've moved through this disappointment, I've developed a three-part framework that might help you navigate your own expectation-reality gaps. Number one is to acknowledge the gap. What specifically did you expect? What actually happened? What emotions did the gap between your expectations and reality trigger? Number two is to extract the lessons. What unrealistic expectations did you have? What aspects were in your control? And what the heck are you going to do different next time? And number three is to reframe the narrative. How's this experience going to serve your long-term growth? What surprising positives emerged? And how's this setback going to prepare you for future successes? This thing that I worked on for 3 years was a thing that was important to me. Over those 3 years, my colleagues and friends were also working on things important to them. I cannot realistically or justifiably expect them to care more about my thing than their thing, and everybody has things that are pressing for them at any given time. We're all too close to our own world and too far away from others. I don't hold it against anybody, and I didn't go into this launch expecting anybody to go out of their way and stop what they were doing to support me. All of the stories I told myself about how I did nice things for them in the past, they're irrelevant. They're rooted in my reality, in the stories I've been telling myself, not in the reality of others. I don't know what's going on in another's world. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know what their struggles are or their stresses. You can only control your efforts and the intention behind your efforts. You on your own isn't cynical. It's liberating. Getting to self-sufficiency is a painful process, but I think you'll be happier for the trouble. And when you do get there, you will also become genuinely appreciative of whatever support does materialize, because it transforms unexpected assistance from an entitlement to a gift. This perspective doesn't mean we shouldn't build communities or support systems. Of course you should. Instead, it means we build them authentically without the hidden agenda of future reciprocity. Support others because it aligns with their values, not because you're banking social capital. I'm being hard on myself here, though. Harder than I should be. The truth is, I feel great. I'm on fire right now. I did a thing. It was hard, and I crushed aspects of it. I wrote an incredible book. More so, I went all in. I left it all on the table, and I'm proud of what I did, happy for what it taught me. I'm excited for how much better the next book will be, and the one after that, and the one after that, and that, and that. I invite you to embrace your own expectation reality gaps, not as failures, but as the necessary terrain between where you are and where you're going. The journey matters. The learning matters. And most importantly, your willingness to continue creating despite disappointment matters. Perhaps more than anything else. What you do for work isn't a one and done. You can't think about it that way. You cannot think of your work as a series of 10-day sprints or short hit social media posts. You can't even think in years. Instead, I invite you to think in decades. I invite you to be a grower. Thanks so much for listening to this, for watching this. And if you could think of one person to text or email this to, somebody who might benefit from it or resonate with it, please pass it along. I'd appreciate that. Thanks so much. Hope you're good.